Some people apparently made it through and their homes were fine. We're hearing other stories of people hiding in bathtubs, closets, huddled in buildings while the walls are buckling and the roofs are being torn off.
Hurricane Michael tears a path of destruction in the American South. It's Friday, October 12th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, U.S.-North Korean diplomacy falters. China and Japan host talks. And could America ban all Chinese national students? It's all on today's VOA Asia. Thanks so much for being with us. The relationship between the United States and North Korea has been evolving since Donald Trump became U.S. president. He met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore in June and intends to hold a similar meeting in the future. Christopher Hill is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and also former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. He was asked by VOA's Steve Miller in Seoul to give his perception of the current landscape in Asia regarding Pyongyang.
Well, it's changed a lot over the years. And I think, first of all, with respect to North Korea, the whole six-party process seems to have broken down. And the Trump administration seems to prefer to do this bilaterally and then inform the others afterwards. It remains to be seen whether this is really going to work. Secondly, we have a new government in South Korea. And that government in South Korea seems very anxious to move ahead on so-called peninsula issues, on trying to normalize relations on the peninsula. And the issue is, can that go forward, and it's been going forward pretty rapidly, in the absence of progress on denuclearization? So there's some tension in how that will sort itself out. And then another issue, of course, is China. The U.S. has really kind of thrown the book at China over some longstanding trade and intellectual property rights issues. And I would say the U.S.-China relationship is going through some rough patches right now, meaning that it's to kind of coordinate with China on North Korea. So a lot of headwinds, if you will, and we'll see how we come out of this.
Now, you brought up the six-party talks, which you were involved with. While back, Kim Jong-un called the process broken, not going anywhere. They've been stalled for a long time. Some people have said, including Moon Jae-in, has said that this leader-to-leader approach is something new and why things are moving forward. But at the same time, you get these agreements like the Singapore summit where it's language that looks nice on paper, but it's short on details, and then you have to wait later for working-level meetings to actually hash things out. I mean, giving the stalled process that we've seen in the past almost decade now, what's your take on at least trying something new?
Look, always good to try new things. But I think I have a little trouble with the notion that somehow these leader-to-leader talks are really working, because I don't see any real movement in the North Korean position with respect to denuclearization. They've said they agree with it, but it sounds like an agreement in theory that is something that over the course of time they might or might not do. But I'm not seeing any specific real follow-up on these things. I think part of the problem, at least with respect to the U.S. participation in leader-to-leader talks, especially with North Korea, I think part of the problem is the U.S. is just so ill-prepared as it goes into these meetings, and now we're going to have a second summit coming up. And there doesn't seem to be a real effort to make clear, you know, what we are trying to achieve in these summits. And I think the real disadvantage of Singapore was, you know, a lot of buildup to this event, and then a piece of paper that came out of it, which was far weaker than papers we've had in the past. So it's not at all clear that things are moving.
In terms of moving, you bring up an interesting thing because, you know, if you look at the language coming out of North Korea and South Korea with their joint declarations, it's a lot of rehashing of what was previously said.
Yes.
If you look at the language coming out of the United States, sometimes it's very conflicting because on one side you have the president saying, hey, we want to make a deal, denuclearization is going to happen. But at the same time, it's the old United States line. Sanctions will remain in place until full denuclearization. So with those conflicting messages, what kind of challenges does that present
I think it presents a lot of challenges. I mean, the U.S. has made very clear that the U.S. supports a process that would lead to denuclearization. But at the same time, the president's saying that we're not going to give any sanctions relief until North Korea does everything. Well, I'll leave it to others to determine the practicality of that. But certainly, I don't think North Korea is going to take measures to denuclearize in the absence of measures coming from the U.S.
Christopher Hill, former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. These are the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Doctors Without Borders says asylum seekers banished by Australia to the Pacific island of Nauru have suffered a radical decline of their mental health. Authorities in Bangladesh told local officials to begin preparations for a cyclone targeting the area where Rohingya refugees live in camps. An earthquake collapsed homes on India's Java Island, killing at least three people. And Bangladesh's cabinet approved a draft law prescribing the death penalty for drug offenders. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And VOA News, VOA Asia continues. A frankly odd story now recently emerged out of Washington that could have affected thousands of Chinese nationals studying in the U.S. According to media reports, the White House was recently considering a complete ban on Chinese students studying in America. This despite the fact that Chinese students comprise one-third of all foreign nationals attending American colleges and universities. The proposal was rejected, but its mere consideration, says Terry Hartle of the American Council on Education, represented a radical departure in policy.
This is a considerable departure from anything that has been considered in the past. Historically, the United States has welcomed international students and scholars because we believe that exposing them to market-based capitalism and democracy was a very good thing, especially if it can be done in communities that are particularly pleasant. And American colleges and universities are in places like Columbus, Ohio, Lawrence, Kansas, Los Angeles. I saw an awful lot of Eastern Europeans visited the U.S. as foreign students and scholars and had firsthand access to American society. And that probably was a very beneficial thing in the long run, because once you've experienced and seen democracy and capitalism firsthand, you have a far better appreciation for its strengths and its value than you do if you just hear about it secondhand.
One of the aspects of this proposal, which of course has been rejected, it is no longer, as far as we know, on the table, is that it no doubt would have brought some economic pain to any number of colleges and universities across the country. In fact, Stephen Miller, who's sort of the immigration policy advisor in the White House, seemed to acknowledge as much in reporting by the Financial Times, saying, well, you know, so what? Most of those colleges and universities, the students and the professors don't support President Trump anyway, so to heck with them.
Mm-hmm. That's been reported in the media. Of course, there's no way of knowing if that was true or not, but that's certainly what has been reported. Yes, eliminating a large number of foreign students would weaken the U.S. balance of payments. Foreign students last year brought roughly $35 billion into the U.S. economy. We gain far more economically from foreign students than we lose. Much of that impact would have hit colleges and universities, but it certainly would have hit lots of small local businesses in all the communities around the country that have colleges and universities and have Chinese students in attendance.
Terry Hartle, Senior Vice President of the American Council on Education. Happening now in Asia, Asian markets fell sharply on Thursday. Stock indexes in Shanghai and Shenzhen both tumbling more than 5%. The Hang Seng Index was down 3.88% in afternoon trade, while the Shanghai Composite fell 5.22%, its worst day since 2016. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. China has denounced an address Wednesday by Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen, marking the island's National Day, vowing to boost national security, and accusing Beijing of seriously challenging peace and stability in the region. The state-run Global Times called the speech full of separatist nonsense and antagonistic thinking. China has cut off contact with the Tsai government since it came to power in 2016 and has increased diplomatic, economic, and military pressure on Taiwan. The Taiwan leader has refused to acknowledge Taiwan is part of One China. Bill Sharp is a Taiwan expert and host of the Hawaii-based Asia in Review online program. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that the Taiwan leader has previously vowed to boost defense spending.
Taiwan in the past has said, yes, 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 we will increase the defense budget to 3% of GDP, but it's never really kind of come through. She also made a point about stemming the infiltration and subversion in Taiwan society, and this all comes from China. And I think this is a problem a lot of countries are having. The United States is having it. China is trying to set up these innocuous-looking organizations in order to sway public opinion. You see it in Australia, you see it in New Zealand, you see it in a lot of countries. You also see a lot of fake news, or what you might call, maybe in a more professionally called, disinformation. And Taiwan is particularly subject to this disinformation coming from the mainland, which is designed to divide public opinion, to create a more divided Taiwan society. She mentioned the upcoming election, which is a big one. This is called the 9-in-1 election, where virtually every local government position in Taiwan is voted for on the same day, and this will be carried out on November 24th. I think that they need to be very, very wary about Chinese influence, trying to influence the election.
She indicated in her speech that China is seriously challenging peace and stability, describing the island that she leads as being on the front line of tensions in the Pacific. How is China seriously challenging peace and stability?
I think they're trying to intimidate. They're doing these missions and bombers, you know, encircling Taiwan and then flying into the Western Pacific. They're definitely trying to intimidate Taiwan, to scare Taiwan. But every time they try to do this, it blows up in their face because it only further unites Taiwan society.
She also mentioned that Taiwan must work with other countries and organizations like the European Union to build a coalition to defend democracy. Is that viable?
I think that's true. You know, I see more and more countries turning out to support Taiwan. I mean, when you really think about it, Taiwan is very interested in maintaining in its relations with its 17 allies, which it should. But the real players here, its relationship with the United States, its relationship with Japan, its relationship with the European Union. And also, I would say, its relationship with Australia and Canada.
She also called on authorities in Beijing to be responsible major power, to play a positive role in the region and the world instead of being a source of conflict.
Well, I'm not sure that they're going to listen to her. In fact, I think it's a pretty good bet that they're not. They consider Taiwan just this little small island and they're big China.
The Global Times said that the speech was full of separatist nonsense and antagonist thinking. Obviously, this is not going to move China closer to Taiwan at all.
No, it's not at all. And I'll tell you this. I spent 4 months in Shanghai, the last 3 months of 2017 and the first month of 2018, and I had the opportunity to interview a lot of China's leading Taiwan experts. And I can tell you, they are frustrated. They're frustrated that Taiwan hasn't sort of gone along with the mainland's wishes, that it's resisted every maneuver that the mainland has made. And I think that some of the actions of China trying to intimidate Taiwan, flipping allies, this is just a manifestation of that frustration.
Bill Sharp, host of Asia in Review, and you're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. According to UN World Trade Organization, Thailand outranks every other Asian nation when it comes to money that tourists spend. Last year, it collected $57 billion in international tourism receipts. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. Australia's Defence and Foreign Affairs Ministers will sit down with their Japanese counterparts in Sydney on Wednesday for their annual 2+2 gathering. China, though not present, loomed large at the gathering. Phil Mercer reports.
The Sydney conference is held as regional tensions continue to simmer. Last week, a Chinese warship narrowly avoided a collision with an American destroyer in the South China Sea. While Japan is increasingly concerned about Beijing's territorial ambitions in the East China Sea, where both countries have competing claims. Boosting defence ties with commitments to hold more joint military exercises have been on the agenda, as Japanese ministers meet their Australian counterparts in Sydney. The two countries are also seeking to enhance their work with the United States to boost investment in infrastructure in the Asia-Pacific region as they try to counter Chinese efforts to cultivate relations with developing nations. Maurice Payne is the Australian Foreign Minister.
We're always pursuing the relationship in a very active way. This is the eighth Japan-Australia 2+2, which we're holding here in Sydney today. And, of course, it is symbolised by our special strategic partnership, and that is a characterisation which is very important to both of us. We'll be very focused on maritime security, on democratic processes to which we're committed, on free trade, on the international rules-based order.
There'll also be more diplomatic efforts to persuade North Korea to dismantle its nuclear program. The ministers' meeting in Sydney Wednesday is a prelude to an expected visit by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to Darwin next month, ahead of a major regional summit in Papua New Guinea. In February 1942, Japanese forces launched air raids on Darwin, the capital of Australia's Northern Territory, attacking US and Australian ships, its strategic harbour, as well as military and civilian air bases. At least 243 people were killed. The raids were an attempt to damage Australia's wartime morale and its military capabilities in the Pacific. Much has changed in the past 70 years. During that time, Japan and Australia have developed very close military and trading ties. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A recent report says that typhoons, the Eastern Hemisphere's hurricanes, are getting stronger and possibly more frequent, testing the resilience of Asia's booming but fragile megacities. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Florida Governor Rick Scott promised a strong relief effort from his administration after the state was slammed by Hurricane Michael. The hurricane was the most powerful storm on record in Florida's panhandle and the third strongest on record to hit the U.S. mainland. Michael made landfall Wednesday in the Florida panhandle with maximum winds of 249 kilometers per hour, putting it just below Category 5 status that tops the scale used to describe the strength potential of hurricanes. Wendy Victoria is managing editor of the Northwest Florida Daily News. She told VOA's Sarah Williams about what is known about the damage sustained in hard-hit Panama City.
We have been unable to reach officials there, and even local officials, like sheriffs in neighboring counties, have been unable to reach people in Panama City. We're understanding that there's very, very limited cell service and that power was out as of last night in 99% of the county. Some people apparently made it through and their homes were fine. We're hearing other stories of people hiding in bathtubs, closets, huddled in buildings while the walls are buckling and the roofs are being torn off. We've had a very difficult time getting information and even getting in touch with our staff members who work over there.
I believe you have a sister paper there, the Panama City News Herald. What has that building, what kind of damage has that building sustained?
Our company is still trying to reach that building. We're understanding that it's in an area that's being controlled by FEMA at the moment, so there is no access into a wide portion of Panama City. What we know is hearsay that two portions of the building, including the roofs, collapsed, or we've heard that. We, again, can't get there to see it. The door may have been blown out, and I think the room where the press, our press room, I think the roof is destroyed over the press room.
And what have you learned about the area around, for instance, like the town of Apalachicola, which I think bore some of the brunt of the hurricane?
We have a reporter from our paper in Apalachicola since before the storm. We sent her over there to provide coverage for the region. We have papers stretching from Apalachicola and Port St. Joe all the way back over to Santa Rosa County. So we cover, I'm not sure what the distance is, maybe 150 miles of Florida Panhandle with all of our properties. She said Highway 98 is impassable, which is the major east-west road along the coast. There's damage, debris on the road. It's not clear how much of it is damaged, but she was unable to travel on it this morning. The main interstate that would connect Apalachicola to our area or even to Panama City, that is closed at the moment. About 80 miles of that is being closed while highway officials sort that out and figure out what's wrong with that road, if anything. I believe Apalachicola took on a great deal of water. She was in the downtown after the storm, and the businesses did take water in. There's trees down on homes. There's a lack of power. And the last that she was able to determine, some folks on islands had been cut off, and it was unclear how they were doing. There was no one was able to reach some of the people that she'd interviewed right before the storm. She was then unable to reach them after the storm.
And then there have been rather dire reports about the town of Mexico Beach.
That was what we're hearing was ground zero for the storm. We have been trying to reach people in Mexico Beach. Our reporters worked into last night trying to reach out to the few people that were on any type of social media. We have not been able to reach anyone in Mexico Beach. It's a tourism stretch along the Gulf of Mexico, and we've not been able to reach anyone. It's between Franklin County, Apalachicola, where our reporter is, and Panama City, and that is where the storm came in, as well as Tyndall Air Force Base, which is one of the large Air Force bases, and they have reportedly sustained serious damage as well.
But I guess from a good news perspective, where you are, Fort Walton Beach, and also the nearby city of Destin, have made it through fairly well.
We were braced for a more of an impact, and certainly in Walton County, which is really just 20 miles away from where homes were just leveled. Walton County was braced. They were under a curfew. They were pulling fire crews off the road, as the storm was coming in. But what the people we've spoke to in Walton County, they were out and about and trying to reopen their businesses and had maybe some power outages. But the damage we saw was a torn awning and a potted plant tipped over and relatively minor damage. So Walton County is, South Walton is rocking and rolling back up largely for business, I think, as soon as their power comes back on. Destin was mostly untouched. I'm not sure if there was some beach erosion, but Destin was in great shape yesterday afternoon. And Fort Walton was, we just had, we had winds and a little bit of rain. Same with Navarre. So high surf would be the only possible remaining issue over here, but no real damage to speak of, particularly when you compare it to what happened in Panama City.
Wendy Victoria is managing editor of the Northwest Florida Daily News. She spoke with VOA's Sarah Williams from Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And that's VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Always glad to have you with us. We will be back with you again on Monday. Hope you'll join us then as well. And until then, have a great weekend.